broadcasting live from the fiery crucible in which all true heroes are forged. This is Pop Culture Reference, your one-stop reference for all things pop culture. I'm one of your hosts, Master Sergeant Farrell.
And I'm your other host, Seamus Connolly. And man, would I love to wake up to an "on your feet, maggot" every day. That would really get me up out of bed, I feel like. That's been an alarm on someone's phone, I'm sure. That has really worked wonders.
If you did not figure it out from the intro, which, given the underrated nature of this movie, it's entirely possible you didn't. Today we are covering the underseen 2014 banger, Edge of Tomorrow, or as it was known on home video, Live, Die, Repeat, Edge of Tomorrow, starring Tom Cruise, Emily Blunt, and the incomparable Bill Paxton as Master Sergeant Farrell. We don't have any news this week, Seamus, so do we just immediately transition into the main segment?
The only news we have is that there's an invasion being planned, and we need to be on that beach, buddy. Like, I think we should just get right into it. On your feet, maggot!
For today's main segment, we're going to be covering Edge of Tomorrow, or, by multiple choice, Live, Die, Repeat.
I'm going to go ahead and say I'm staunch. Get Live, Die, Repeat out of here. I love this movie. I think Edge of Tomorrow is just fine. I think the way that this movie was received upon release, or I guess not received, as you mentioned before, by many, many people, I don't think it's in the title. I think this movie is phenomenal, and with the weird stuff that Tom Cruise has a stranglehold on now in Hollywood, I would love to see another one of these at some point, or another thing like this. I think it's phenomenal.
We are covering this film for its 10th anniversary, but also, it's funny you bring that up, recently when we discussed Tom Cruise's new relationship with Warner Brothers, something that has been brought up is the potential of a Edge of Tomorrow sequel. Do I really want to see that? Maybe that's spoiler talk. This movie alone is, I mean, I'm going to say top three Tom Cruise movies, one of my favorite action movies. Maybe, probably, almost definitely my second favorite time loop movie.
It's definitely up there for me, too. I, like many people, did not see it when it came out in 2014, unfortunately, because I also was like Elysium and Oblivion and all the other weird super movie star / specifically Tom Cruise sci-fi movies were coming out, and I was just, I don't know, I wasn't there for it. I wasn't a Tom Cruise guy yet. Maybe it's because I'm kind of a latecomer here, but like I said, I want more of this movie forever. It's phenomenal. It's already like a pretty decently lengthy movie, but I would have easily tacked on a whole other hour of time loop shenanigans, and I might even say this is my number one time loop movie, if I'm really trying to think hard about it.
Those are strong words, Seamus, because Groundhog Day is a masterpiece.
Groundhog Day is great. Groundhog Day is fantastic. And maybe it's because I haven't seen Groundhog Day in years, and maybe it's because I've seen Edge of Tomorrow again so recently, but man, is it a lot of fun. I love it so much. And there's still plenty of great humor locked in for Edge of Tomorrow. If it was too over-serious, I don't think it would take that title, but it really holds strong.
There's nothing wrong with Edge of Tomorrow, and I think I mean that. I don't think there's a thing I would maybe make a couple of sequences a little bit more brightly lit. That's like my big change for Edge of Tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. Oh, honestly, I agree with that. Towards the end, they really are out there in the dark for a while. But yeah, I pretty much agree on everything else. These performances are phenomenal. This is maybe the movie that you showed me to like dip my toe in the Tom Cruise pool. I don't know. Maybe there was something else before this, but
I mean, this is pre-Mission Impossible. This is pre-Top Gun Maverick. Yeah. For you specifically. Obviously, he had already done, well, Top Gun Maverick would not come out for a long time after this, but he had done Ghost Protocol by this point up through Mission Impossible. It was between 4 and 5. But yeah, for you, this is all new Cruise stuff.
it was basically like my like second Tom Cruise movie after watching the original Top Gun on VHS when I was like 10 years old. So it was really, it really blew my mind. I mean, I can't sing the praises of Tom Cruise and his physical acting enough in this, especially with the gear that they have on this whole time. Emily Blunt is maybe the most badass I have ever seen anyone in anything ever. I wanted a whole scene of Verdun and her backstory and all the extra stuff that comes along with her. And then, of course, Bill Paxton. I mean, unbelievable, mustache and all. One of the, if not the last, role that he was in?
He was in some stuff after this, but yeah, it wasn't things like after? A crazy in here. I'll IMDb it real quick. Yeah, he was in, I didn't know he was in The Circle. Did you know he was in The Circle? The Emma Watson, Tom Hanks YA movie?
Yeah, what? That's bizarre. It sucks that we have to watch The Circle now, huh? Yeah. That's wild that we just have to add that to the list.
Yeah, Nightcrawler was after this. He did some stuff after this, but it is coming up on his last few roles, for sure. And frankly, as much as I love Bill Paxton, and it's a lot, his best role, I think. He's incredible in this.
He gets so much amazing loop time. You know, time loop things can get a little bogged down if you're not, like, the most likable, charismatic, Kentucky-voiced actor in the world that gets to deliver these lines like the pro that you are. I mean, it's, you can't take your eyes away from it. Every new loop in this movie you are excited for. Sometimes loops can get frustrating in movies if you do them so much, but even how rapidly it happens in this movie, when you really get into it, you never get tired of hearing his speeches. I mean, that's how we intro this show. It's just too incredible, too iconic to ignore.
And speaking of career bests, I want to back up to Emily Blunt for a second. I definitively think this is her best role. She is so good and nuanced in it, because a lot of the time you can be a badass in a movie and then not show any cracks. And there is so much interiority to this character, even before she starts letting other characters in. You can see little moments with her from an audience's perspective that are really, really strong. I also think, speaking of character work, Cruise is doing kind of an atypical role for him in this era. This was a little bit of an interesting time for him. He was doing things like Rock of Ages and experimenting a little bit more with, you know, what the Tom Cruise brand was than he does, you know, now per se. But channeling a much more smug, smarmy, he's not a good dude, really. He's not a brave dude. He's not a nice dude at the beginning of this movie. Again, think Phil Connors, and that is worn on this movie's sleeve, that influence, because obviously Emily Blunt's character's name is Rita, which is not a coincidence considering Andy McDowell in Groundhog Day is named Rita.
Man, I really should rewatch Groundhog Day, huh?
That's,
I mean, it also
that
probably helps that I didn't
that.
Even
That's
know
crazy
because well, I know that that is her name in the book that this yes. movie is based on as well. And that book came out in 2004, I believe. So I'm sure that is also not necessarily a coincidence either.
Absolutely
but
not.
And that would be, I think, fascinating for us to go read. I want to try those manga comics out. I know they were released in English at some point when this movie was happening. So I'd love to go see more of those connected details there.
All You Need Is Kill is the name of the manga, and
All You Need Is Kill.
It's supposed to be really good, and quite a departure, actually. The movie, I think, takes a lot of liberties with its source material, which is not a bad thing. This was directed by Doug Liman, who we just covered one of his films recently. We did Mr. and Mrs. Smith. And as charming and fun and competently made as I found Mr. and Mrs. Smith, this is his opus. This is an incredible piece of action filmmaking that tops everything else he's ever done. And this is the guy that invented Jason Bourne. He changed action movies forever.
Yeah, but I mean, there's such a singular charm about this specifically. It's somebody who's like their incompetence is overtaking their survival at every turn, pretty much. It's not only just an interesting angle for action heroes, is that you know, starting off truly incapable of surviving for more than 10 seconds. And it's just such a weird thing to have Tom Cruise specifically take on that role, wherein I only know him and anything else as the most competent, straightforward, intelligent, tactical person on screen at all times.
I also want to bring up, while we're discussing Lyman, I should backtrack my statement. I am aware that Robert Ludlum created Jason Bourne, that Jason Bourne is a book character, whatever. Okay, that's out of the way.
But, like,
yes, he created the Bourne, the aesthetic.
The film.
Yeah.
Yes.
This movie written by the Butterworth brothers, who are also the guys who wrote Ford v. Ferrari and Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. But
who never heard of them? Moving on.
Brought in by Cruise to do a rewrite was, I know if you don't already know this, Seamus, I'm sure you can guess, our sweet baby boy, Christopher McQuarrie.
Christopher McQuarrie, yes. Yeah. Of course, of course. And so it shall be, and so it shall be for the rest of time after this movie specifically.
And I think the results speak for themselves. A super tight screenplay. One of the tightest time loop screenplays. I know I just sung the praises of Groundhog Day over and over, ironically and fittingly, I suppose. But this is probably the tightest time loop screenplay of all of the time loop films I've ever seen. That is no small feat, and it's a very hard genre, I think, to get right tonally and pacing-wise. So not only is the screenplay great, the action is great, and the performances are great. What more can you want, Seamus?
It's truly one of my all-time favorites now. I'm sad that I did not get to see it in a theater. That is my own mistake, but I will rewatch this movie pretty much any time. This is one of those ones you could throw on. And I mean, that is also to the credit of how they crafted the time loop and how they structure and edit all this, that it is pretty much endlessly watchable. It is very charming where it needs to be. It actually really, you know, has a very good few heavy moments that they fit in there with the characters that they rise up through these loops with. I'm a big, big fan.
Yeah, it's definitely really strong tonally at writing a balance between fun and dramatic. Fairly heavy at points, but at no point does it tip into melodrama, I would say.
Definitely agreed. I think it's very well balanced. That's why I like want a billion more versions of this in different ways. I love the design of the creatures. I love that I don't have to know all of the tiny details about what they are and how they do the things that they do. I'm very satisfied with how they bring you along for the ride without giving you the old Chris Nolan, don't think about it, you know?
Mm-hmm. I also think that there is a really useful shorthand in how much they are invoking real battles of history that obviously Verdun is a World War I battle, famously really brutal, terrible meat grinder stuff that is then referenced as a previous battle in this film. Same thing, obviously, a big part of Edge of Tomorrow is spent focusing on storming beaches in Normandy. You can't get more direct of a reference than that. I don't think they even mention it in the movie specifically, like Brendan Gleeson.
Yeah, it is.
Who we haven't even brought up yet somehow, Brendan Gleeson,
oh my God,
is in this movie. And terrific in it. He has kind of a thankless role, I think, but does a really good job with it.
I was going to say, he is phenomenal. He is almost forgotten because you would imagine an actor of that caliber and how well he is doing in that role that there would be so much more of him. But you really lose track of him for most of the movie, and you only get him back for a more intimate moment way towards the end of things. I think he's fantastic as well.
Do you think that we could say anything else without spoilers, Seamus?
I think we should lift the veil, dive in, tip of the spear, edge of the knife. I think we got it. We really got to do it.
Absolutely. Let's call spoilers for Edge of Tomorrow.
It's weird to call spoilers for a movie that we are celebrating the 10th year anniversary on a little bit, but it really lays it all out pretty fairly well in the very beginning here. You have a real jerk, Tom Cruise, gets his skull melted in by alien acid blood, which is truly a very upsetting image in this movie, if I'm being honest.
It's incredible.
The close-up of, like, his cheekbone melting into his face is really nasty stuff, but God, the tactfulness in how much the violence really is brutal, too. I mean, there's some pretty legit moments of blood and dismemberment and holes in chests and people on fire like it's truly Saving Private Ryan on the beach. My favorite stuff here is these Big Mac suits, the guns, the way they're fighting on this beach is so weirdly fluid despite how clunky everyone is clopping around out there.
I can't even remember back in 2014 when I went to see this, if I knew it was a time loop movie. I mostly remember seeing Tom Cruise in a mech suit as a promo image, being like, same kind of like you. I was like, Elysium, Oblivion, whatever. I don't really care.
Yeah, God.
And then going and getting my mind blown at how much I enjoyed that movie. Because I was kind of, as much of a Mission Impossible guy as I am, you have to understand, at this point in my life, I think I had only seen the first Mission Impossible and Ghost Protocol. And to me, those were more like director's movies than Tom Cruise movies, even as much
as
Ghost Protocol is a, you know, stunt showcase for Cruise and the genesis of the Tom Cruise stunt showcase. But this was in an era when I didn't necessarily see Tom Cruise and think, well, that's going to be a good movie. I should go see that.
I'm truly jealous that that's the experience you got to have. You had no expectations for this movie, it sounds like. It didn't sound like you were gearing up to get your mind blown in any capacity. So I'm sure you were just sitting there in the theater buzzing with how interesting this movie really is.
Yeah, it's a really incredible first watch. I think it takes you on such a journey. And you were mentioning earlier how they explain just the right amount about the science fiction and the time loop of it all with Noah Taylor, who we didn't even mention pre-spoilers, who, like Brendan Gleeson, has kind of a thankless role of just being the science nerd. And I think it does elevate it a little bit past that point. I do think it's a little odd that he doesn't get to go on the last mission.
Yeah, the final mission to the Louvre, you mean? Yeah, like, he should have been on that. He should have been one of the sacrificial last stand moments, maybe. I don't know. I don't want to put that on him, but you get it. He's an important guy. He's been, like, tucked away in this in this mechanic role on a military base in the middle of nowhere.
Because I feel like he gets more development than J-Squad, and if you watch that last loop with that in mind, they go from Cage finds Rita and tells her about that what's happening to him. Then they go to London to get the device to read it. He gets taken out of the loop with the blood transfusion. Then from that point on, they basically go collect J-Squad and go to the Louvre. So I don't even know if in the last loop that character is aware that there is something like this going on.
Yeah, I guess not. I mean, they have some of my favorite stuff in this movie where they are doing their, like, timed waltz into Brendan Gleeson's office towards the end to get the device, like, get all the stuff. But, yeah, you don't really think about how they weren't necessarily planning for that to be the successful run or anything. They kind of specifically don't plan for that to be the successful run because he has no idea what to do at a certain point. So you really do get caught up in all of that, and you forget about our boy, Mr. Bucket from the Toothpaste Factory. His voice, in this movie and everything, he has that, like, lisp accent with him, everything that he does. It's very charming when he plays things in, like, Paddington and stuff.
And here he's so manic, which I don't think he is. He's very subdued in a lot of his roles, but whenever they pull him into their little secret base with the hologram screen. He has to learn every time, and Tom Cruise is like, yeah, get you two fingers behind your back. I'm her before Verdun. Do you get it? Great. Good. Thank you.
I mean, that is also one of the greatest joys of this movie in general, is hearing Tom Cruise's really crisp wrap-ups that he has to do every time he meets back up with either of them. It is some of the... And of course, when he has his little closed eyes dodging fist, the fist coming at his head moments with J-Squad, who are looking for him.
I think my favorite is when he gets in to J-Squad and is just trying to rush it along as quickly as possible.
These aren't officers' cufflinks. I think those scenes are so great. Just, like, calling what hand they had in cards and, like, kind of making Sergeant Farrell feel bad for, like, not letting him do his thing. Yeah. I feel bad. I want him to be able to finish his thing. He's great. I wish there was more Battlefield. I almost wish they brought him along for the final mission, you know? But yeah. I know that is...
I just don't think that
there's no way that is realistic for how much I love that character. He's not going with J-Squad.
Absolutely not. And he gets some great moments. He gets the, when it's still first run coward Private Cage, he runs into Sergeant Farrell when he's running away from the beach, and Sergeant Farrell gets to turn him around and make him go into battle.
Into the fiery crucible in which all true heroes are forged. Mm-hmm. I love how, like, they bully Tom Cruise. I've never seen Tom Cruise be bullied so much in anything. And he's just like, everyone's loving how they're going to kill this guy, basically. They're like, oh yeah, we'll march Tom Cruise to his death. We think it's hilarious. Like, we're totally on board.
And I think part of the reason that the finale isn't super gut-wrenching when we watch all of J-Squad get killed, I think it's a very interesting choice that the characters that die immediately in the finale, the characters that die in the hovercraft crash, the helicopter crash, are the characters that are kind of the most deplorable up to that point. The ones who seem the meanest and the most excited about Tom Cruise getting killed. Because as much of a coward as he is, are we really super jazzed about him dying? And interesting.
That everyone really is, though. Yeah. I don't know. It is rough. They're all, you know, laughing at him every... Like, he just wants to know how to take the safety off his gun. How much would your stomach be turning if you were just dangling over the abyss like that? And you were just like, I just want to know how to maybe survive more than 10 seconds. And they're like, me too, man, me too.
And
it's horrible.
I do understand, like, he's a danger to others at that point in his character.
Sure, I guess.
But after... It's when he is... It's not even the first time that Cage is killed that makes me like, ooh, guys, come on. It's when he starts being nice at a certain point in the time loop, and they're still just like, we don't believe what he said. Yeah. We know that we've been told you're a deserter. That's all we need to know because of groupthink. You deserve to die because of that. That's period. End of story.
But
we're gonna revel in
that
your
makes
death.
It makes it all that much more satisfying when he does do the, like, he runs around the sand pit in that, like, single motion and, like, sweeps all the mimics around them, and they're all just like, what is happening with Cage? Them being proven wrong that he is, like, the most badass guy on that beach now is so tight.
It's pretty good. And I love, I think it's during the part where he decides that he can't watch Rita die anymore, when he's drunk in the suit and he's like, I need, like, a million clips and a million grenades.
Yeah.
I don't wear a helmet because it gets in the way.
It slows me down. Yeah, God. Love the evolution of his drop, too. Just, like, watch every... That's something I tried to pay special attention to this time around. It's just the very subtle differences between him hitting his superhero pose on the ground.
Mm-hmm. That first shot of him falling through the air and, like, different guys in the dropship hitting each other midair, and
oh god, the guy who's on fire who's like pancaking other dudes who aren't on fire yet.
That's a shot that you see a lot in modern movies, I think, of a guy long take falling out of a aircraft. That feels really CGI and rubbery a lot of the time, but it works for me because it feels so seamless with the rest of the action. I also think about the movie Overlord, which, not to get too much into Overlord, that shot always makes me think of a similar shot in Overlord.
Yeah, I think I know exactly what you're talking about.
It all works together really seamlessly because, unlike a lot of Tom Cruise movies, there's not a lot of stunts for him to be doing, really. I mean, it's impressive that he's running in the big suit. It's impressive that he's, like, on a wire getting dropped 20 feet or whatever. There's a bit at the end in the Louvre after the big explosion when he rolls down a big pavement ramp with a bunch of glass flying after him. Like, I don't care how padded the styrofoam whatever that the fake concrete is made out of is, that would be painful. You're falling a long way.
Yes. You're getting hit by objects that are physical. You are going to feel that for sure.
So I think it's an interesting Cruise artifact. And again, one of the Cruise films that I hold in the highest esteem. And it's not just because he's a maniac. It's because he's doing good acting with a good ensemble cast made by a good director and written by writers who did a good job on this movie, at the very least.
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. Wait, I have a quick question that you probably know the answer to, and it's probably a dumb question. Does Tom Cruise fly that helicopter for real in this movie?
I don't know. That's an interesting question. Oh, I think you and I should
both... Wait, does Cage fly the helicopter at all? Wait a minute. Now am I...
Yeah,
am
there
I
are a couple... Yeah, he flies the helicopter after he's sick of watching Rita die. Which
right,
is...
he doesn't even meet up with her, and he, like, goes alone to the helicopter. Okay. Because yeah, he probably 2014, he probably knew how to fly a helicopter, right?
Certainly, he did. I would imagine the answer is yes. I don't know that offhand. You and I should break out our respective copies of Edge of Tomorrow that are sitting on our shelves and just check the special features.
Yes, we definitely should. I know Emily Blunt did, like, some of the driving stunts, and I assume Tom Cruise was in the car with her if that was the case, so I imagine he probably did.
I love it when they rip the roof off the minivan to get the guns against the mimic who's in the camper behind them. So good.
They peel it open like a tin can, and Tom Cruise just emerges with his salvo shoulder units. I love those things, by the way. I don't know if I say that enough when we talk about this movie. The shoulder missiles that just, like, go off as he's shooting in four different directions already. It's so good. I love the design of that suit, and I know Tom Cruise was, like, very actively involved in designing it to be practical, or as practical as possible. So I know that thing was absolutely so heavy.
It also makes me think, both the design of the helmets, it makes me think about the Colonial Marines, but their suits make me think about the Turboloader from Aliens, which I think is all the more impressive that there are essentially no jokes about aliens other than the fact that Bill Paxton is a military guy fighting aliens.
Yeah, that is a hell of a lot of strength. I do know the arm machine gun sound design is, I think, directly based on the Aliens assault rifle gun, but that's also just like a hyper, like a future-y machine gun sound. So that fits seamlessly, but also seems, you know, they definitely did that very much on purpose.
I even think that the mimic's mouths have a xenomorph-esque quality to them. And like the shape that their heads are in a lot of the time. I know they're made of like weird fiber optic cables or whatever, but...
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, you know, a smoother idea of an alien face, you know, it's very fluid almost feeling.
Which is
a ball of tentacles, yeah, I mean.
So good. I love the design of the weird, like, jellyfish vulva omega. The
omega, yeah.
Omega.
Omega. That's the whole movie. That's what I was doing. I couldn't help myself, but... Yeah, the weird, like, flower sarlacc pit thing that they have to... One of the most hyped-up shots of the alpha, like, screaming in Tom Cruise's face underwater.
Mm-hmm.
And him, with the Omega out of focus behind him, like, opening up the palm of grenade pins. Cinema, Garrett. It's so good.
I think you and I discussed recently that I don't really love the fight through the Louvre to get to the Omega. But I will say, once Rita dies, which is a very, like, intentionally, I think, a very unceremonious death for her.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she just kind of, like, she does save Cage, technically, but she just kind of gets wrecked by an alpha.
Yeah, she just gets ripped apart, yeah.
And you see her blood fly, which I think is pretty graphic. Again, there are bursts of graphic violence in this film, which I think are very effectively used. But from the time that you see his hand open with the pins all the way through the finale of him waking up on the helicopter, the great, outstanding last shot of him just bemusedly laughing, smirking at Rita. Incredible. What a way to end a movie. It's so confident that you were invested in what came before that they're like, yeah, you know what is going to happen here. And we do. And Dude. They have such great chemistry and it just works. And it cuts to Love Me Again, which I had.
Yeah.
That was the free. There was a free single on iTunes in like 2013. And so I like knew that before I saw this movie, and I was like, that's not a great song or anything, but I think it's it's kind of a bop, but it's a bop in a very like 2014 way.
It's a very goofy cut, I feel like, because I'm like on my feet by the time Cage walks back into the like Robo Dojo where she's doing yoga, you know. The Robo Dojo Casa House, of course, famously.
Incredible shit.
Real life Ken Tom Cruise for multiple reasons. He walks swaggers back in. And I'm so enthralled by his look and his smile and the words that I don't even have to really hear him say, but then it cuts to the weird song and it really slams the brakes on it for me.
I don't know, you need a hard cut to music, I feel like. That song starts with a pretty hard you know.
That's true. The energy is high because you are in with the victory. You are there for Victory Day with Cage. It feels great. I do think it's fun. That's why I'm so hard pressed for more of this story or character or characters or just idea in general. Just make it a prequel about Verdun, you know? Like, I wouldn't even mind that simple move to move forward there. I mean, it would be a lack of Tom Cruise, which would be very hard to swallow in the Edge of Tomorrow franchise, but
I don't know. I'm in a place with this movie where I'm like, it just ends so perfectly for me. What else is there to tell?
That's where I run into it. It's like, I know that there's nothing else to tell, and that's why I'm like, I really don't want more. I just want the same movie, but, like, longer, I guess. Yeah. I want the anime adaptation of the manga to be released, which might or maybe not be a thing. I don't know. But I'd watch a whole franchise of that, man.
I would just as soon have a spiritual sequel to Edge of Tomorrow where Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt fight aliens, but it's a different franchise, you know, where it's not explicitly Cage and Vertaski teaming up.
I don't know, man. I love everything about the design and the feel of this world. I'm like hung up on it. I shouldn't be. The suits are phenomenal. The weaponry and the gear. Even like, I'm trying to remember Homeboy's name who gets crushed on the beach. We made it. I love that guy. Why can't I remember his name?
I have
my third grade teacher.
It's a two syllable. Funny little name. I don't know. I don't have it, though.
I mean, that's the only other thing that leads me to be like, I want more, is that I want, like, the J-Squad show. What if it's just a show with his loops with just J-Squad?
Okay,
I would watch that forever.
Okay, you want my... I've been thinking about it for a total of 45 seconds. Here's my...
Give it to me. Give
Edge of Tomorrow 2 pitch. 10 years has passed. The aliens were vanquished, but like Noah Taylor says... For all we know, there are millions of these things floating around on asteroids like a cosmic virus waiting to impact a living planet. A asteroid has hit Mars.
Oh my God.
Humanity, using whatever advanced technology that Noah Taylor has produced and the insight gained from Emily Blunt and, of course, on the cutting edge of military technology, going from a cowardly little weasel to a true hero and champion of all mankind, Cage, not only developing incredible space technology that, you know, he may or may not be able to fly at supersonic speeds up into the sky, but they are going to take the fight to Mars, to the Mimics, and make sure that they get eradicated, dude. Because this is our solar system and we're taking the fight to them.
Dude, it's like a Cold War style, like, we know they're building their numbers up there. We have to strike before they're able to get into the atmosphere. Because, like, in the world of this movie, Cage is still the, like, military spokesperson for the United Defense Front, or whatever it is. So he's got some weird influence where he's like, I will lead the charge. Brendan Gleeson still thinks I'm an alright guy, maybe, kind of. I haven't blackmailed him yet.
Then you have a younger protagonist, let's say Glenn Powell.
How did I know, Garrett Strother? How did I know?
Who is on the first wave and gets got by a Alpha, same way as Cruz. And now, Furtasky and Cage are out of the loop, and they're the support staff to this new guy.
Oh, dude, I would kind of love Cage out of the loop. Him trying to keep up with things would be very fun to ride around. But I mean, you could even almost do it like Charlie Bucket Sr. is like, oh, I'm reinstated and I am experimenting with, like, how do we instill the powers of the Omega with the last little bit of Tom Cruise's blood from whatever loop. I don't know. Could be some kind of given. I feel like if they did it the same way as Tom Cruise in the first one, it'll be a little too.
That's true.
On the nose.
That's fair. Listen, this is
45
seconds. This is a fake
pitch for a movie.
tossing it around. But
true. We've got plenty of time before we bring this to Tom, you know? We'll perfect it before we get into room with Cruise.
Also, I don't know who we're going to bring in to match the energy of Master Sergeant Farrell, but Bill Paxton will be sorely missed.
Yes, there will be a Paxton-sized hole in that segment. But I mean, there is no recast. That's out of the question. No. He is laid to rest in Science Hill, Kentucky, obviously.
Yes,
but
there was a mine that took him. He defused, saving the rest of J-Squad when they were moving across
France. Am I crazy to put a mustache on, like, a Dave Bautista or something? Another, like, stout, yelling person?
I could see that.
I don't know why the mustache is like a must, but it kind of is.
No, the mustache is a must. I agree with you.
It's part of that role, you know?
I also believe that as perfect and flawless as this pitch is, and I think we're ready to take it to Tom right now.
I think so.
If there's one guy in Hollywood that I trust to figure out how to make Edge of Tomorrow 2 work, it's Chris McQuarrie. So,
you know what? That's really who we need to get into the room with. We need to inception Chris McQuarrie to allow us to be graced with his writing skill and attention, because he is really. Could you imagine, like, him really helming the thing? It would be unstoppable.
Ooh, that's an interesting question. In my head, I was just like, Doug Liman's coming back, but Chris McQuarrie doing Edge of Tomorrow 2.
I mean, why not, you know?
Edge of Tomorrow.
Oh, don't do Edge of Yesterday?
It would be live, die, rinse, repeat, or something stupid. It would be like
live, die, born, repeat, and it's Jason Bourne being born,
dude,
on Mars,
dude,
in an inverted Tenet loop.
I was gonna say Chris Bubby Tenet with Edge of Tomorrow, and he would be like, "Sold, boys. You're my new number one
Sold.
Guys."
Let me get Tom out of his cage. I'll bring him into the room to meet you. You'll hold out your hand and he'll sniff it and he'll decide if he'll be friendly with you or not.
Garrett Strother, like Chris Traeger from Parks and Recreation, like, he looks you in the
eye.
That's
really what,
and he's like,
and he says your name,
and he will never forget it. He'll never forget it.
I believe that. He will ride into the cosmos one day with that it locked in his memory.
And we'll say, Tom, I'm going to tell you a story. And at first, it's going to sound ridiculous, but the longer I talk, the more sense it's going to make.
Knowing that he is right, I'm like, maybe you're right, Tom Cruise. When I hear him talk like that, I'm like, maybe I will hear you out, Tom Cruise, buddy. I'm watching the movie. I'm seeing what he is seeing.
So I know you and I are both rec-centering Edge of Tomorrow for this episode where we already spent our time singing the praises of Edge of Tomorrow, but Is there any final thoughts that you have about this film before we kick it on over to the pop culture reference?
I love it so much. It is nonstop fun, and really, again, I can't express, the moments of humor are so well embedded into things. It's one of my favorite action movies of all time, and high up there on the Tom Cruise chart in terms of, like, complete watchability. I feel like I could recommend this movie to probably literally anyone, and they would get a lot of enjoyment out of it. So, if you haven't seen it, if you were one of the people like me in 2014 who just, like, fully blind to this movie, didn't even care a little bit, I recommend you, make up for that lost time and go watch Edge of Tomorrow.
I absolutely agree with you, Seamus. I think that's the perfect way to put it.
So how's about we go and we talk about our pop culture reference this week?
Let's do it. For today's pop culture reference, we're going to be talking about the history of time loop films. Countless pieces of fiction throughout history have utilized the idea of time travel to create unique stories, but the specific convention of the time loop in motion pictures takes it a step further by creating a unique rhythm of nearly identical scenes that interact in different ways. The first recognized film that utilizes a time loop plot device is the 1947 fantasy noir Repeat Performance, revolving around a woman who relives the past year of her life preceding the murder of her husband by her own hand.
What is widely considered the quintessential time loop film is the 1993 Bill Murray classic Groundhog Day, which blends the inherently dark tone of the concept of being trapped in an endless time loop with rom-com elements. The Marvel blockbuster Doctor Strange introduced the time loop to the superhero genre, the Happy Death Day franchise has cornered the modern horror angle for time loop plots, and Andy Sandberg's high-concept comedy Palm Springs has evolved the idea even further while maintaining a specifically light tone.
This plot device of revisiting previous points in time throughout the film allows filmmakers to shoot much more usable footage at once, with variables in costuming, set design, and actor performance being kept to a strict minimum. Continuity between scenes, however, is much more vital than any other subgenre, as the audience is allowed to become so intimately familiar with the details of any given scene in a single viewing. Edge of Tomorrow, though based very heavily on the book and manga All You Need Is Kill, pulls from many of these film elements established before it, and arguably perfects the action flavor of time loop plots in live action. You and I talked about this a little bit during the main segment, how we feel that Edge of Tomorrow is toward the top of any conversation that has to do with time loops, but I do have to say, I love Happy Death Day an awful lot, as nowhere near as good of a film as Edge of Tomorrow or Groundhog Day. I think it's a really fun, irreverent little time that finds its own corner of the sandbox to play in without feeling too derivative, and in fact, acknowledging directly the work that came before it.
Yeah, I have yet to see Happy Death Day. That's another time loop movie I just fully wrote off for some reason when it came out. But I know you have been a big fan for a very long time. I think I need to finally get on that. I was a big fan of Palm Springs, too, when that came out. That was some good old pandemic straight-to-streaming fun that I actually thought was a very fun take on everything. And honestly, I'm a little bit surprised we didn't bring up Tenet in our main segment a little more than we did. I think we maybe mentioned it a single time, but that has become definitely a modern time loop favorite of mine.
Yeah, it's time loop in a very indirect way, which I don't think we should get too far into. If you've not seen Tenet, go watch it. But definitely, I mean, it's very interesting to think about time travel movies that are not explicitly time loop movies, but have the same pleasures as time loop movies. Back to the Future 2, for example.
Yeah, you know, I was trying to think about the Back to the Futures and their time loop elements, and they really do have more than I remember, and it's maybe been a while, but just the ideas of getting right back to the anchor of things. You know, they don't do as many rapid takes or anything like that, but there is a full loop in general.
Yeah, for sure. So, excited for whatever the next time loop movie to come out and really bring its own spin to the genre is, because I think that you can do this with anything. If you can do a time loop movie with horror, I think the world is really your oyster at that point.
Oh yeah. That's just a sandbox. You could pretty much film a whole movie with that idea in your head, and you would probably come up with some pretty fun stuff.
But what do you say we go on over and save the rec center? Save the rec center!
Now it's time to save the rec center, where we give you our weekly recommendations. Garrett, what do you got for me?
I usually wait till we get far enough into a season to rec center something, but this is a limited series, and I think it should be more in the zeitgeist, so I'm going to prematurely rec center a little bit. The FX original series, also streaming on Hulu, Shogun, which is a adaptation of a novel. Also, I have recently learned that it was a miniseries in the 80s with Toshirô Mifune, but it's a really fascinating feudal Japanese story about there are these Westerners that have made their way over to Japan, while at the same time there is a war brewing for the crown, for the empire of Japan, and our boy Hiroyuki Sanada is one of the leads in the show.
Yes.
As is Anna Sawai from whatever that show was called, Monarch, Legacy of Monsters. I almost said Godzilla, King of the Monsters.
Oh, no way.
So,
while she was great in that show, it's awesome that she's in this one. People have been going crazy for it.
I've been really enjoying it, Seamus. I think you should get on it. I am an episode behind right now, but am very excited to continue.
Well, yes, I'm going to check that out for sure.
But what do you have to say with the rec center this week, Seamus?
I revisited an absolute classic, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Charles Dance, the last action hero. Excuse me, last action hero. No, the. I've been incorrectly saying that for years now, because it's been many, many years since I've seen this movie. But man, is it really good. I think it's hilarious. Just enough meta jokes to make me not, like, roll my eyes every 10 seconds, but really appreciate how, like this is the thesis of Arnold Schwarzenegger knows what kind of movies he makes.
Mm-hmm.
And even in that insanely meta concept, you think it might be a little bit over the top, but it's just really fun and charming. And Schwarzenegger as Jack Slater, as Schwarzenegger, as Jack Slater, is just really, really incredible. Evil single glass eye Charles Dance is a phenomenal villain. I feel like I don't really see him in young roles, but he is just chewing it up out there. He's having a great time with his, like, Joker length pistol that he uses. It's so much fun. It's peak 90s. If you ever want to see a movie world where not only is Robert Patrick himself walking around as the T-1000, but also Terminator 2 is a real movie in universe and is starred Sylvester Stallone, it's just a lot of fun. It's goofy, it's action-packed. The kid isn't super annoying, as some kids in these kind of sidekick roles can be.
Interesting.
It's phenomenal. Lots of fun. Are you a fan? Have you seen this? Are you a fan, Garrett?
I haven't seen it in a long time. I do like it. One of the main things I remember about that movie is the kid being super annoying. So I'm
and that's what I remember too, Garrett. That is what I remember too. But I promise you, Austin O'Brien, he is not as bad as you remember. It's really cringy when it's like Schwarzenegger's hot daughter is like kissing him on the mouth or whatever with her eyes closed and stuff. But besides that, Garrett, don't think about that. Think about the other fun stuff. Think about the cartoon cat who's a detective with a black and white Humphrey Bogart. It writes itself, man. It's hilarious.
That movie
it's so
is
good.
Like the perfect intersection of Roger Rabbit and Demolition Man.
Exactly.
And both films,
what's
I
not
love.
To like, you just sold it.
Yeah. And so I should really revisit it. You didn't even mention the incomparable John McTiernan being the guy who directed that movie.
Yeah, I somehow slipped that, even though it's kind of the most John McTiernan anything could ever be ever. It's so wild.
Well, you have inspired me. I will revisit Last Action Hero very soon, I assure you. It's Arnold Fever, baby. He's in that new Santa movie. He just presented with Danny DeVito at the Oscars.
Arnold Schwarzenegger walked out naked to present costuming. Yeah, we all were there. We remember.
They should do a movie together, if I'm being honest. John Cena,
yo,
and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Father and son, John Cena and Arnold Schwarzenegger. I'd watch it. That would be a day one.
Day one. We do it twice in a row for this show, probably.
Once for Arnold, once for John.
Exactly. That's what I'm thinking. One week we're broadcasting live from John Cena's bicep, and the other week we're broadcasting live from Arnold Schwarzenegger's bicep.
I've never seen Twins, but what if it's a Twins sequel where John Cena is Danny DeVito's long-lost son, and they have to go with that Arnold uncle?
That's really fun. They were going to do triplets in the 90s with Eddie Murphy, but I like your pitch better.
Oh my god.
Actually.
No, that's pretty incredible. I don't know, man.
But what sold me is John's, like, Danny DeVito produces John Cena is a very funny scenario.
I could see him sitting on his lap like Buddy the Elf, almost, like, so big compared to him.
Ricky Stenicki, streaming now on Amazon Prime, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, sure. Good lord, we are in the weeds with John Cena somehow right now. He's not in Last Action Hero, Garrett.
He should be in a legacy sequel to Last Action Hero that's set in the Last Action Hero universe.
It's called The First Action Hero, and it's a Jack Slater, young Schwarzenegger movie that old Slater goes to with the magical ticket. You forgot that it was a magical Houdini ticket.
No,
didn't you,
of course
Garrett?
I didn't. Of course I did not forget that. I am a man
of
culture, Seamus. But
you,
the idea
you understand
of
magic.
Last Action Hero gritty reboot within the world of Last Action Hero.
Oh, dude, it's Jack Slater 1.
Perfect. Jack Slater colon Origins.
They get Austin O'Brien back. I don't know what he's doing right now.
Probably being a dentist or something. Like, that's what kid actors always are.
Charlie Bucket?
Charlie.
Is that what he did?
Charlie Bucket, yeah. Which is, I mean, it's most fitting there, but, you know.
Most fitting there. But, I don't know. He could, little Danny, he could have grown up to be, like, a failed action director or something. He's making the bad reboots of Slater,
famously played by Glenn Powell in the reboot.
You know what, that's the real move right there. You know what, Austin O'Brien, whatever, hardly knew you. Like, let's get Glenn Powell in here.
What's this podcast about again?
It's about wrapping up the show. And if you want to reach us on social media, that's at @PCR_podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Like us on Facebook, subscribe to us on YouTube. You can email us directly at popculturereferencepod@gmail.com. Next week, we are watching the original Patrick Swayze Roadhouse. Neither of us have seen it before. This is truly going to be a wonderful experiment in 80s cinema. I'm very excited to watch that one and discuss it with you.
Sam Elliott's maybe in it? I don't know. We'll find out.
Whoa, big news. Dude, we truly don't know anything. This is going to be the funniest episode of this show.
We're both going to hate it. It's going to be awful. It's going to be...
We'd be like, I prefer the reboot. We'd be those guys. We're finally going to see it. Oh, maybe. We'll see.
Everybody, I am looking forward to reporting back about Patrick Swayze and Roadhouse next week.
Adios, amigos.